You are listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people who make them and do not necessarily represent the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or any of its affiliates or advertisers. Hi, folks, and welcome to The Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this gorgeous place we call Earth. Thank you for being here at The Kevin Smith Show. Some of you are joining us for the very first time tonight, and you need to know that we have a free weekly newsletter. That free weekly newsletter is called the K-Files E-Zine, and here's how you subscribe. You just go over to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, and you'll see a little button there with red letters that says K-Files E-Zine. And you click that and subscribe. It takes about 10 seconds. You can unsubscribe anytime you want to. There's no strings attached. And we will email that to you each and every week. It comes out on the weekend. And so you've got time right now to sign up if you haven't done it. Be sure you do. All right. Now, There's something interesting that I ran across, and maybe to you, maybe you might say, okay, that's no big earth-shaking deal. Okay, maybe not, but I think it's very, very interesting, and that is, you know, on Mars, we have the Phoenix lander, and then two rovers, but we have the Phoenix lander, and you know that it's already scraped up water ice, and they verified that. They've already said that the soil is, and I quote, it's like the dirt in your backyard. You could grow asparagus in it. They've now said they have detected snow falling, and of course that flies right in the face of what they've been telling us about the atmosphere on Mars. But here's the interesting thing. They scooped up some dirt, and they did an experiment. And you remember the deal was they said, oh, we found perchlorate in the soil. And, you know, that might be toxic for life. And I came on the show and I said, that's nonsense. We have perchlorate here on Earth. And 27, that's more than half, 27 of our 50 states have levels of perchlorate that the EPA says are way too high. We're all living. Maybe it's not good for us, but we're all living. And then now, you know, I found out, and this was I told you about this, very interesting. They said it was perchlorate. Well, what that is, that's one atom or molecule of chlorine bound with six oxygen. That's perchlorate. Well, when they did the chemical analysis of it, they did it, you know, they put the soil in a little oven and heated it up, vaporized the soil, and then sensors decided what was in that. Well, they said it was perchlorate, but they didn't find any chlorine. They just found oxygen. Remember? Remember when I told you about that? Okay, here is a sound bite, a clip from 1976. When the Viking lander did its experiments, and this is the chief biologist on that program.
What we have found, in fact, is something like 15 times as much oxygen in that atmosphere as we can account for from known sources.
How about that? 15 times more oxygen on Mars than they can account for from known sources. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is William Warrick IV. He's been with us before, and it's always exciting when he's with us. And I think that you are in for a treat. The story that I have just related to you about the oxygen on Mars. And I played that sound bite from 1976. We'll deal with that probably next week at some length and in detail when we do an open line show. But I thought you would want to hear it. I thought you would want to experience for yourself the fact that this is not new news. NASA already knew the dirt on Mars produces lots and lots of oxygen. So they already knew it. My guest, as I said, is William Warrick, and he is really a very prolific investigator of UFOs, and he is a very prolific writer and journalist and public speaker on the subject of UFOs. His work has appeared in major media outlets. You've seen on our website, I listed a few of those for you, and there are many more. And we're very, very pleased to be able to say, William Warrick, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're delighted to have you with us this evening.
Hey, Kevin, it's great to be back. It's been a couple of months, I think, but I'm glad that you're up and running again and going to looks like you got a better format there, and everything looks good.
Well, actually, we never stopped. We did get struck by lightning, but we did just move. I think we did rebroadcast for a week, but I moved the studio to another location, and so we could continue with the live broadcast. Now, the last time...
Glad you're back. I'm looking forward to sharing a lot of the stuff that we've learned since the last time we talked, for sure.
Well, good. I also want to get into some things we really didn't get a chance to last time, and kind of mysterious things that I have wondered since they happened. I have wondered whatever happened with that. And one of the things would be the Hale-Bopp situation, and also the your information about the UFO Philadelphia experiment connection. But bring us up to date. What are some of the things that the hot items that have been coming across your desk since we talked last?
Well, you know, of course, everyone's familiar with the Stevensville incident down in Texas that caused quite a flap early in January this year. And that was probably the last good flap that we've had in the United States. However, if anyone's paying attention to what's going on around the world, we've got the a huge flap going on in Britain.
Yes, we do, as a matter of fact. Yeah.
I mean, record amounts of sightings in Britain, Great Britain. And, you know, it seems that the phenomenon has a tendency to, sort of occupy an area for a little while and then move to another area, perhaps on the other side of the world. And it seems like there's sort of a saturation process going on where, on a very much more frequent basis, we're seeing and having these interactions with UFOs, and it seems to be building to some sort of crescendo.
I was, for those who are watching on our internet television channel, you see me looking around and going through papers. I was looking for a story that I had in my hands earlier before the show, and I can't find it, of a mayor in some town there in England that are in the UK. I'm not sure it was England, but it's in the UK. And it's, you know, the mayor reported seeing a UFO and was asking for citizens who also saw it to come forward and you know, well, let's get this, get the, these reports in. And the reason I found that interesting is because here you have a mayor, and he's not trying to put the he's not trying to squash the story. He's trying to get people to come out and talk about it if they saw it, you know. And that's a really, in my opinion, that's a big step in the right direction to have elected officials being honest about this.
Well, you know, taking the cue, maybe not so much from Governor Syrington's revelation, the former governor of your state, but all around the world, the leaders of the defense departments and institutions that are set up for the, you know, national security of their states and their nations are really, really concerned about what's going on. And they, if I give you an example, at the X conference, Stephen Bassett's X conference here in April that we went to, one particular individual that stood out was Paul Hellyer.
Yes.
I'm not sure if you've ever interviewed him, but
no, we can't get him on the show. He's got people around him that don't let us get to him.
Well, I mean, and the reason for that is because, I mean, he's an actual, you know, I can't remember his exact position with the McCain.
He was the defense minister.
I was just going to say he's essentially the Secretary of Defense for his country,
mm-hmm.
which is an extremely high position. And he said point blank, you know, the Canadians, him in particular, as the leader of the defense establishment for the Canadian government, or former leader, I think he's retired now, but still holds a lot of weight, still holds a lot of respect, is very concerned that our country, meaning, you know, the United States, may start a conflict that we can't control. And this is, it wasn't like UFO sort of a lecture or anything like that, although, of course, this was, we're talking about UFOs, but, I mean, there was a very real concern that something could happen, that an incident could happen because we're intercepting these craft, and possibly cause some type of conflict that we cannot control. That's serious.
Well, yeah, that is a very serious concern. I will tell you that I don't think that I honestly don't think that the United States would do that. It is something to think about, and it's certainly something that, you know, it's a consideration that has to be on the table, and it's a concern that has to be voiced. But at the same time, I honestly don't think that the United States would decide to pick a fight with something that can turn us into a cinder floating in space. I really don't think that would happen. Now, having said that, let me also say I have been quite surprised by some of the decisions that our country has taken within my lifetime. And some of those decisions are decisions that I said they'd never do it, and they did it. And I don't think the military leaders, those, you know, the generals, the admirals, the top brass, I really don't think they would go pick a fight that there's just no possibility of winning.
Yeah, I need to qualify that statement a little bit, and I totally agree with you. I think the main concern, as we had the Cold War, was that a conflict would be started accidentally. In other words, and I'll give you a perfect example of this. If you recall the interview we did with Terrell Copeland, who captured that amazing footage of two F-18 fighter jets intercepting that floating boomerang-shaped object. When you look at the video, it looks like the thing almost collided with it. So clearly there was a policy of the government to at least molest, investigate, or, intercept, at the very least, any type of unknown flying object. And I think that the main concern is that these types of operations will inevitably result in some type of catastrophic event.
Well, they might.
And the case in point would be, like I said, that clearly video that's on YouTube, or put it up on YouTube, so everyone can see it. That was an event that, had that gone wrong, who knows what the consequences of that might have been. We don't know how those ships are powered. We don't know if there's radioactive material that can be spread across the country. We don't know if that's going to initiate a nuclear fusion reaction and, kill 20 million people. We just don't know. And I think that is really the main concern that the United States government is really, I guess, pushing the envelope in terms of what is safe and what is, acceptable, I guess, in terms of safety.
Mm-hmm. The Stephenville thing, I found that to be excessively interesting. And the reason, and for those who, for some reason, don't know about what I'm talking about, the Stephenville thing, I'm talking about a major UFO sighting in Stephenville, Texas, or over Stephenville, Texas, over that area of Texas. That one was really, it was interesting all by itself, but was really important and exciting because there were so many witnesses that came forward, and whenever the spin story came out from the Air Force, the witnesses laughed at it, and they wouldn't back down, and the press didn't back down, and they kept reporting on it, and they reported on it rather responsibly, I thought, in most cases, and so finally it reached a point where, it was like, okay, well, we blew that cover story, so we just won't talk about it. And
the funny thing is, they're not very creative. If you look at the pattern that the government takes whenever one of these events occurs, it's always, first of all, they deny that any aircraft are in the sky, just like they did with the Phoenix Lights case.
Uh-huh.
And then, 2-3 weeks later, oh, yeah, we had a squadron of F-16s, and they were flying over there. And we just forgot, that it's a federal regulation of fire flight path, and that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, uh-huh. It's really not too hard to discover, so to speak. You don't have to be a super sleuth to see when the cover-up is taking place, because they're just not that good at it.
Well, and that's, I say it all the time. Look, whether I agree that they should use a cover story or not, I do understand that there are situations where people feel they need a cover story. I'm talking about police agencies. I'm talking about military. I'm talking about intelligence agencies. And they feel they need to use a cover story. All I say about it is, if you feel you need to use a cover story, for God's sake, get better script writers.
yeah. Well, from a public safety standpoint, again, if you're taking, the past history, Symington, for example, he said, although, and I don't believe all of that, what he said, I know that there are other reasons why he, made a spoof of the whole situation. And basically, he did have a very good point as the highest elected public official in that state that, if he had come out, and said, oh, yeah, I saw this thing, then there might have been some, uncontrollable public hysteria. It's happened before. It happened in Ecuador when they did the Martian invasion story with H.G. Wells and all that stuff. Orson Welles, I'm sorry. I forget what it was, 52 people. The people of Ecuador were so mad about it, they burned down the radio station and killed, 20, 30, 40 people. So, clearly there's a history that the government knows about that, you have to control hysteria and you have to control what's going on. But at the same time, this has been going on for so long that I think the longer that we put off the education of the public about, you know, what's going on and what are the various angles of, you know, what the interactions with these things could be, the more it's difficult it's going to be to control hysteria. So,
well, let me say this. I don't believe that I don't buy the idea that anyone anywhere can control the reactions that the public will have to information. And I think that government leaders also do not buy the idea that they can control the reactions that people may have. So what they attempt to do is control the information. Since they can't control the reactions, they control the information in an sort of an attempt at making sure they don't get those reactions. Here's the problem. The problem with that is whenever it finally does break loose and the truth bubbles to the top, it will do so more explosively if you've been restraining it. It's like a pressure cooker. You put and some of the young people don't know what that is because the only way they cook is microwave. But you put something in a pressure cooker and you put it on the stove. If you don't have that safety valve at the top to let some of the steam out, the thing will explode. And when you put a lid on information, it's like putting it in a pressure cooker. And it gets hotter and hotter and hotter, and sooner or later, it will come out. And when it does, if you've been suppressing it, it's going to come out like an explosion, like an exploding pressure cooker.
Well, you know, clearly, as you pointed out with the Stevensville case, the number of, and if you look at it objectively from a journalistic point of view, you know, I'm always scanning, you know, the news wires, trying to find the latest info and the latest scoop. And, you know, clearly there has been an exponential increase in not only the number of reports from mainstream media that are reporting UFO events, but the number of in-depth reports that are done on mainstream events. And, of course, it's far and pales in comparison to, you know, what really needs to be done. But at the very least, I think the general attitude of people is changed a lot from the sense of being this whole sense of fear and skepticism to one of sort of hope and optimism that these events, you know, may provide some sort of change in consciousness for the way that we're living our lives. Because when I study the UFO situation, I really see, it really tells me more about us as human beings than it does about, you know, any potential extraterrestrials. Just by watching the reactions of us as a society and as individuals to basically all that it is new information. You know, it's a different paradigm, it's a different way of looking at things that takes it from a solar-centered point of view or an Earth-centered point of view or, you know, my little circle of friends point of view and expands it into a truly cosmic, universal intelligence. And so I really look at the UFO situation as sort of the gateway towards the evolution of our species, because, you know, we're really at a point where we really have to take responsibility for our actions. And I think that the UFOs are sort of like a mirror upon us where, you know, we have to look at ourselves and judge ourselves the way that, objectively, the way that perhaps an extraterrestrial would. In the sense that, you know, we have to look at how we use our energy, we have to look at how we treat each other, we have to look at how we treat the planet that we live on. I mean, there's just nothing else out there. There's no place else to go.
Bill, we have to take a break, and ladies and gentlemen, we'll be back more with William Warrick IV right after this, so don't go away. Well, Welcome back. This is the Kevin Smith Show. I'm Kevin Smith, your host. And let me remind you that the music you hear during commercial breaks here on the Kevin Smith Show comes from independent artists. You can find them at a couple of different places. The primary place to find the artists that we feature is GarageBand.com. And the other place is PodSafe.com. And you can go over there and listen to all the music you want absolutely free. And you can download lots of it absolutely free. That's the place to check it, GarageBand.com or PodSafe.com. My guest this evening is William Warrick. And we are talking about some stuff that he's investigated, UFO investigations. He's very active and actually a very prolific UFO investigator and writer. Also a filmmaker. Now, William, I'd like to, if you don't mind, I would like for us to sort of get you to fill in for us some of the details that maybe we've missed on one of the really big incidents that took place. Actually, it was either 1996 or 97, somewhere along in there, and that was Hale-Bopp, the Hale-Bopp comet. And, you know, lots of people remember that associated with the incoming Hale-Bopp comet, there was an incident that took place with a group called Heaven's Gate. They believed that there was a fleet of UFOs coming in toward the Earth with that comet, and that they were going to be picked up and they were going to be taken off into the heavens by these UFOs. And ended up committing suicide, the whole bunch of them. And and there was a big flap. Art Bell had been talking about the Hale-Bopp comet, and there were people who tried to say that the Heaven's Gate incident was his fault, and that was absolutely nonsense. You know, we talk about all kinds of things on this show. If someone hears something on this show and there's something wrong mentally with them and they react to it, respond to it, I am sorry, but we're not inspiring people to take their lives, and neither did Art Bell. However, there were two names associated with the happenings back then, and I haven't heard what is the deal with them. What one is Craig Button, and the other was Amy Lynn Svoboda. What's the deal with those two folks?
Well, you brought up three very good points. And first of all, I'd like to say that, you know, it's true. Art Bell and anything that Art Bell did with this show regarding Hale-Bopp and any alleged connection between his program or anyone else's program and the suicides of the members of Heaven's Gate is total rubbish. I've been in contact with one of the former members of Heaven's Gate that didn't commit suicide, that left the group about a year or two prior to their suicide. And those people firmly believe that they didn't actually believe that physical bodies would be taken up with the UFO. They believed that when they committed suicide, that basically their soul would be sort of transmuted through and into, I guess, other containers. And sort of correct me on this, that's actually what they believed. And this goes back to the 70s, and it had nothing to do with anything that Art Bell and Ralph said. The second thing, in regards to Craig Button, and is that Craig Button was a U.S. Air Force pilot who was an A-10 captain, and it was in the Davis-Monthan base in Arizona for, I believe, a couple of months doing some training at the airfields down there. And apparently, according to news reports that we had on April 2nd, which, by the way, was within 24 hours of when Hale-Bopp reached the closest point to the sun, which is called perigee.
Now let me ask this. Was that 1996 or 1997?
That was 1997. Hale-Bopp reached the closest point to the Earth. Here's one of the anomalies of Hale-Bopp that's very interesting. Hale-Bopp reaches its closest point to the Earth on March 22nd, 1997. And then it reached the closest point to the Sun on April 1st, 1997, which was just about 8 or 9 days later. And then within 24 hours of Hale-Bopp reaching the closest point to the Sun, which is basically the closest point to the Earth as well, Craig Button allegedly took off from a three-man training mission where he had four live MK-500-pound bombs attached to his aircraft and was about to conduct his first live bomb practice. Now, allegedly, this man, Israel pilot, who had basically a flawless record, allegedly took his aircraft and flight 800 and some odd miles and crashed it into the side of a mountain in Colorado. Now, if you believe it, the story that far in terms of what the government says happened, and then the second thing that happened after that was that apparently, from all the information that I've been able to gather, his trainer, who was named Captain Amelia Svoboda, who was also from the same air base, apparently she allegedly crashed during another training mission at night in May, which was just about 6 weeks after that. Now, the issue or the problem with both of these things is, first of all, I mean, Craig's disappearance, alleged disappearance, it was just an anomaly in and of itself. In fact, the Secretary Cohen at the time said that he used the famous quote from Winston Churchill that it was a mystery wrapped in an enigma inside a riddle. To this day, I don't think anyone can really say exactly what happened or why he allegedly broke formation and committed suicide, which has never really been proven, as far as I'm concerned. And then you have, of course, the death of his trainer, or a trainer from his base. I haven't been able to confirm whether or not she was actually his trainer. For all I know, she could have been, one of the other two planes that was in the formation that day. It wouldn't be out of the realm of possibilities to assume that that could be true. I'd like to know. Hopefully someone will come forward and be able to clarify that. But certainly when we have the death of two decorated captains in such unusual circumstances, so close to the Phoenix incidents, it certainly makes one wonder whether or not there's some kind of cover-up taking place.
All right. Now, Bill, let me ask you this. The Captain Craig Button disappeared, and they said crashed into the side of a mountain, and it was said that that he committed suicide. All right, that happened in March?
No, that happened 2 weeks after the Phoenix flights. That happened on April 2nd, 1997.
Okay. So 6 weeks later, Amy Lynn Svoboda, also a captain in the Air Force and a trainer, and she crashed. And what did they say about her crash?
They call it a pilot error.
Okay. And what do you think?
Well, I have heard reports from confidential sources that apparently those pilots were not in control of their aircraft. Now, I don't know if that means that they were somehow incapacitated from controlling their aircraft. I don't know if that means that they were being controlled remotely. I don't know. I cannot say for certain what the implication of that statement is. I can only tell you that I have heard reports from very good sources that something really unusual has happened. I've even heard one report from a former military official who stated that Craig Button was actually abducted, some kind of UFO, and that they, dropped fake parts on the mountain. And keep in mind, they didn't find the aircraft or any of the wreckage for almost, I think it was 27 days after he allegedly, disappeared. And there were a lot of very unusual things regarding that whole incident. I've detailed pages and pages, 40, 50 pages in my book. that, you know, clearly show that there was some type of cover-up, or at least we're not getting all the information. The government may very well not know what happened to him, but at the very least, they are covering up what they do know. And really, if you care about the military, as I do, you know, you want to have answers to these things and at least be able to, prevent some of these incidents from happening in the future, perhaps, or find out what happened. I really think there should be a congressional investigation into finding out what happened to these decorated Air Force captains and many of the other anomalous crashes that seem to occur during that period of time that still haven't been explained.
Well, there were a lot of strange things happening in that period of time. For instance, in April of 1997, NORAD stopped all public tours. Why?
Well, the story that they put out at the time, which really didn't make any sense, was that they were concerned about the Oklahoma City trial of Timothy McVeigh. But the statements that they made in the time period of when they, you know, supposedly were concerned about some sort of terrorist attack against the most heavily fortified defense installation in the world, it was almost laughable. And the time period when, you know, when the trial had begun and when they had issued, you know, the statement that this was the reason why they were closing tours was just absurd. And the evidence clearly points to the fact that they're very concerned about some sort of, you know, basically a UFO invasion from some type of ET craft.
All right. Now, why do you say that it seems clear that that was the case?
Well, if you look at the timing of how everything transpired in terms of, for instance, like the Phoenix Lights occurring on March 13th, and then you follow the crash of Troubleshooter 615 on the same night at 11:19, and then on the same night on March 13th at 11:03 p.m., just 9 minutes later, Governor Symington witnessed the huge UFO over Phoenix. Simultaneous to that event, on the East Coast, President Clinton allegedly injured his knee and is taken away to Bethesda Naval Hospital. There seemed to be, you know, pandemonium, spurts of pandemonium when these UFOs reports were at their peak. That result in very real crashes of aircraft and a threat to the United States. And they took it seriously.
Okay, so what you're saying is that if you don't look at just one incident, but if you back off and take a wide view and you look at the big picture, there were a lot of things happening in close proximity to each other in terms of time, and when you look at all of that, you have to wonder, what's the deal here?
Oh, absolutely. And actually, for twice, the first time, just to give you an example, on August 22nd, 1996, the military suspends routine air operations after a series of they call them air accidents, you know, crashes of military aircraft, in the United States and all around the world. And then for the second time, and again, this would have been just about the peak time to hear about how it was approaching us. For the second time on September 17th, 1997, the military suspends flights and off flights again. Now, leading up to the September 17th, 1997, which is the second time in history, or I should say only the second time in history that the military suspended all air operations, you had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Within 3 days, you had six aircraft, military aircraft, crash in accidents.
How many?
Six. On September 13th, 1997, a German and American spy plane collide in the middle of the daytime off the coast of Africa. The next day, a U.S. Navy F-18 crashed in Oman, killing the pilot. The same day, an F-117A stealth fighter crashes after a piece of the moon breaks off. If you recall, that was during the Baltimore
air show where William, the break is on us. The music has started, and it's going to cut our mics off. We'll continue with this when we come back on the other side of this break, folks. And as you can see, lots of stuff is going on, and connecting the dots is the name of the game. We'll be back. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Smith, your host. We're talking with William Warrick. And William, when we had to cut away for break, you were telling us about all of these crashes that had taken place. If you would like to continue, please do.
Yeah. Well, beginning on September 3rd, just to recap, on September 13th, two German and American spy planes collided in the middle of the daytime off the coast of Africa, which is unusual in and of itself, which you have two of the most advanced aircraft in the world colliding in the middle of nowhere. And then you had two military crashes on September 14th. And then on the 15th, you had an F-18 that crashed off the coast of North Carolina, and the two pilots were killed. Very next day, on the 16th of September 1997, you had two F-16s collide off the coast of New Jersey. And this is very interesting, on that same day, the Air Force announced that they were ending the search for the missing four 500-pound bombs that were lost from Craig Button's A-10. So even though Craig Button allegedly crashed his aircraft, 800 miles from his base in Colorado, they still were looking for the bombs up until September 16th, which is, of course, many, many months later. Now, that is sort of the cap on that whole spat of aircraft incidents, military aircraft incidents. On the very next day, after announcing that they were going to end the search for the 500-pound bombs, on September 17th, 1997, the military, for the second time, only the second time in history, suspended all flight operations, basically a stand-down. 2 days later, on September 19th, 1997, a B-1B bomber crashes in Montana, and apparently there was some scuttlebutt with this, that it was unusual because of the ranking officers that were in the aircraft at the time, if I recall correctly. I believe it was like a brigadier general and very high-ranking colonels and stuff like that, and it was unusual to have that much brass in a B-1B. And so you have, just in a period of 6 days, more loss of military aircraft than we've lost in I think, the whole Gulf War. with 10,000 sortie operations.
What do you attribute it to?
I'm sorry, say that again?
What do you attribute that to?
Well, one of the very anomalous things about Hale Bopp, another very interesting fact that wasn't never really got any report on, was the co-discoverer of Hale Bopp, Edwin Hale, died in a mysterious car crash near Alice Springs on July 18th, 1997. And certainly, if you wanted to get into conspiracy theories, if there was a cover-up of an alleged UFO invasion or fleet traveling with Hale Bopp, the death of one of the main discoverers would be something that would raise some flags. And from what I understand, obviously Alice Springs in Australia is a major monitoring facility for the National Security Agency and a lot of other monitoring space operations for that side of the Earth, that covers that side of the Earth. And so also, too, apparently the files, the investigation files of that are sealed. Cannot get any information about that.
All right, so are you, let me put this package together and ask it this way. Are you saying that it appears that the reports that we heard back in 1997 that there was possibly there were possibly some spacecraft traveling with Hale Bopp. Those were ridiculed. Those reports were ridiculed by mainstream sources. But you're saying that possibly that is the case, and that they are responsible for all these plane crashes? Do I understand correctly?
I would say the evidence is overwhelming. Yeah, absolutely. I don't think there's any question that something along those lines is what happened and was related in some way to many, if not the greater percentage of all of these mysterious aircraft crashes and lots of satellites and mysterious deaths, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I really don't think that I could ignore all of the evidence that's there.
Okay, so if these spacecraft then were in fact traveling with Hale-Bopp, and if they are responsible for these aircraft crashing, why are they responsible? Why did they make them crash? Or, you know, what's the story with that?
Well, you know, I think it all kind of goes back to, you know, Paul Hellyer's voicing his concern over the fact that, and again, going back to the clear evidence that I've, you know, seen, you know, with that video, clearly demonstrates is that, you know, just the very act of intercepting these craft could either result in unknown forces of physics that, you know, could cause problems with the aircraft and cause them to crash, like the loss of electrical systems, which has been reported in many cases. A good example is the the Phantom Iranian case in September 1976, where when the Phantom aircraft, which is an American aircraft, tried to intercept the UFO, all of their flight instruments went dead. All of their attack instruments went dead. I believe they were still able to control the aircraft. But certainly, if the policy of the United States military is to intercept every single UFO that they come across, you know, the unintended consequences of doing that, I think, is what all of these crashes may be indicative of. I don't necessarily think they're going out trying to shoot some of these down, although I certainly can't rule that out. But I think it certainly seems as though, as the former Canadian official from Canada has stated, that we're really rolling the dice every time that we go out and try and intercept these things without giving them some kind of leeway, it seems. So that's what I think happened, and that's what I think is kind of continuing to happen, although obviously not in so much intensity. And maybe they've, you know, got a policy to back off, I don't know. But certainly, if you look at the spat of aircraft crashes that occurred within just a two-year period of time, it certainly would indicate that something very unusual is going on.
Well, it certainly would seem so. Do you think, let me check the clock. I have a bad habit of not doing that. We've got about a minute and a half. All right, before the next break. So let me ask this. Do you think that these aircraft become disabled simply because they get too close to these UFOs, and perhaps there's some sort of an electric disturbance coming off of the UFO? It's just there. It's not being fired at them. It's just there as a function of their propulsion or something like that. And the aircraft then just, it interferes with the aircraft instruments. It becomes disabled. Or do you think that these spacecraft actually took action against our aircraft?
I think it could be both, actually. You know, one of the scuttlebutts of the Baltimore F-117 having its wing break off was that allegedly there was a cloaked UFO, you know, floating above the airfield, and that it collided with it, which would certainly explain how, you know, the tip of an aircraft like that breaks off. It was certainly an unusual occurrence. I mean, you know how boxy the F-117 is. It's not like a normal wing, so... it was certainly the usual thing that happened, and who knows, there's certainly lots of cases where these UFOs are reported to have, you know, cloaking or invisibility capabilities, so there's definitely not beyond the realm of possibility that they could have either inadvertently crashed into one, or that the propulsion system had affected its avionic systems and caused the crash, or that perhaps they perceived these military aircraft as a threat. And that's an interesting point that you bring up, because it appears that the civilian aircraft were not in the same category. All of these crashes that, you know, that I investigated were all military aircraft, and so perhaps they perceived them as a threat and, you know, took some kind of defensive action to prevent a possible altercation.
Wow. Well, I knew that the Hale-Bopp story had to have a lot more to it than what we were getting. And, you know, like so many of these stories, it came... and went rather quickly. Lots and lots of important stories. You know, they come up. It's the talk of the town, and then all of a sudden, nobody's talking about it anymore. And that has happened with the Stephenville case. People are not talking about it with as much interest as they did. And, you know, people have a short attention span. But there are always more details than we get. And I knew that this Hale Bopp story had to have more details than that. Now, we're going to take a break in just a few seconds. When we take this break, ladies and gentlemen, we normally come back and open the phone lines. I'm not going to open the phone lines just yet because I want to explore with you, William. I want to explore the death of the co-discoverer of Hale Bopp. I want to explore that a little bit more in detail before we open the telephone lines. Fascinating stuff. Now, again, how many airplanes was it? What was the total number?
Well, just in a seven-day period in September of 1997, we had, let's see, 9 aircraft lost in a six-day period of time.
All right, we'll be back, folks, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. I'm Kevin Smith, your host. My guest this evening is William Warrick. And we're talking about, lots of different things related to UFOs. But specifically, I wanted to dig into this Hale Bopp thing that happened back in 1997 and see if we could elicit some details that we had not perhaps examined before. And this is fascinating. In just a few minutes, we're going to open up the telephone lines for you, and you'll be able to call in with your questions or comments. But I want to continue here for just a moment. We've got just a little bit more that I want to sort of pick your mind on, Bill. Now, one other thing. I got a flash message that I checked during the break, and someone wanted to know what language is that song in. That is Russian, and Da Panimayesh Ruski Malinki. It's a good song. Oh, you speak? You speak Russian?
No, but we've had a lot of Russians working for my construction company here, and they're good people, good hardworking people.
Oh yeah, I love the language. I learned the most important sentence in Russian was the first thing that I learned in Russian. Что вы желаете пить? What do you want to drink? All right. Now, I want to dig into this a little bit more here. I want to get to this mysterious death of the co-discoverer of the Hale Bopp comet. But before I do that, let me ask this. You're saying that the evidence is overwhelming that there was, in fact, a fleet of UFOs accompanying the incoming Hale Bopp comet. Aside from these strange events that all seem to have taken place rather rapidly, is there any other evidence for that? Did anybody see through their telescopes any of these spacecraft?
Well, yeah, absolutely. There's been a lot of evidence, a lot of telescopes, a lot of astrophysicists, some of them amateur, some of them professional, actually talked a lot about the anomalous things that were happening with Hale Bopp. For instance, it was the closest, the Hale Bopp was discovered way out by Jupiter, and it's one of the, I think, only comets that was ever bright enough to have been seen that far out, number one. Number two, if you look at the orbit of Hale Bopp, although it did not pass very close to us when it was closest to our orbit, we were on one side of the sun, and Hale Bopp was passing on the other side of the sun, almost on the opposite side of the sun from us. But the very interesting thing about its orbit, the two things interesting about its orbit, which if you were to go with the whole theory that there was a UFO fleet traveling with Hale-Bopp, was that the orbit of Hale-Bopp brought it, I believe, if I recall correctly, when I did the astronomy program, within maybe 10 diameters of the distance to the moon. So to say that it was I wouldn't call it a near miss, but certainly if you go with the supposition or the preposition that a UFO fleet was traveling as a companion to this comet, then you would expect that if it was coming to Earth, that the orbit of the comet would take it as close to Earth as it possibly could get without danger of tidal forces and gravitational tidal forces wreaking havoc. And certainly the orbit of Hale-Bopp brought it within that predefined sort of expected parameter. So what actually in fact happened is that if these extraterrestrial craft sort of hijacked a ride in the gravity well of the comet, which, by the way, there are a lot of reasons for doing that, and I'll give you three quick ones. Number one, one of the most overlooked factors in space travel is micrometeorite impact. And if you've got a big, huge snowball traveling through space, and you're traveling at the same speed as that big, huge snowball, it's really going to clear a path for you. So you really don't have to worry about your spacecraft being destroyed by micrometeorites traveling at, 100,000, 25,000, 50,000 miles an hour, which could really ruin your day. The second thing is that, as we all know, comets are full of water. And that's essentially the one essential thing that's needed for life that we definitely know about and that we would expect to find anywhere, especially like if we talk about all these things on Mars, that you have to have, which is an abundance of water. And the third thing, of course, is that it could travel in the gravity well of the comet, sort of hitching a ride. Which makes a lot of sense. So there are a lot of reasons, actually, when you think about it, for any spacefaring civilization to, sort of get a piggyback ride on by or with a comet. Now, here's the interesting thing. Although the comet's orbit did not bring it close to Earth when it was closest to Earth, because we're on the other side of the sun, on January of 1998, there was another flap in Phoenix that didn't get as much attention. However, the interesting thing about this is on January 2nd, 1998, that is when the Earth passed closest to what would have been the drop-off point of where these UFOs, alleged UFOs, would have sort of dropped off or got off of the comet and waited for us to come close to them in our orbit.
What sort of flap? You said there was a flap on January the 2nd, 19. What year? 19 what? 98?
Yeah, well, actually, January 2nd, 1998, that's when the Earth passed closest to where the last closest orbit of Hale-Bopp was. So, in other words, the Hale-Bopp had already passed the orbital, the track that the Earth takes around the sun.
Yeah.
And just 8 days after that, after we passed the closest point to where Comet Hale-Bopp was, which again was only if you take into consideration the fact that it took us 3 days to get to the moon, then even with just rocket technology, it would have taken about 30 days to have gotten to where Comet Hale-Bopp's orbit was. Okay, you follow so far?
Yep.
Then 8 days after we reached that closest point to where the comet Hale-Bopp orbit was, we had another UFO flap in Phoenix. So that was one of the really shocking, very interesting things amongst all of the other astronomical, astrophysical anomalies, for instance, the breaking up of the comet, the brightening. It was the brightest comet we've ever seen, probably, maybe in history that we know of. I mean, certainly there might have been more brighter ones, but in history that we know of, I don't think anyone's ever said that this wasn't the brightest comet we've ever seen. And it had these wave patterns, too, that the scientists could not explain, still haven't explained, this sort of ripple pattern to the light waves that were coming from the object. If, in fact, it was a comet, it may not have been a comet. I mean, looked like big dusty snowballs, but if there was some sort of, gravity propulsion on the huge Death Star-type object, let's think out of the box here for a second. Then perhaps, those light waves or the ripple effect that was observed that has still not been explained was some sort of bipartisan propulsion system. You know, we just don't know.
All right, let's take a look at the information on Gene Shoemaker. He's a geologist, and he's one of the co-discoverers of SL9. Now, what is SL9?
Well, SL9 actually was...
That's the Shoemaker-Levy.
Yeah, that was the Shoemaker-Levy 9 comet that broke up and impacted into Jupiter in 1994. Hale Bopp, Edwin Hale, was the co-discoverer of Hale Bopp. Now, Edwin Hale, as we said before the break, the report that I saw was basically that he and his wife were traveling, allegedly, and again, I don't know firsthand, I haven't spoken to his wife, but the report was that they were supposedly traveling to look at an impact crater somewhere in Alice Springs, Australia, and got into a one-car collision with another car in the middle of nowhere, you know, the desert, and literally, you know.
It was a long straightaway too. It was not a curved road. It's a long straightaway, and
yeah, from everything I know about that particular area, I mean, it's basically in the middle of nowhere.
Now, this was on July the 18th, 1997.
Yeah, July the 18th. I mean, basically at sort of the peak of the whole Hale Bopp hysteria, you've got the main co-discoverer of the thing. Dying certainly at the very least, if there is no conspiracy connection, a very unfortunate death. But then, if you look at the fact that apparently none of the files can be opened, but in terms of the investigation of the local authorities from Australia, were from what I understand, prohibited from really investigating what happened. The second thing that makes it interesting is that Alice Springs, of course, is for anyone that knows anything about the military, is a major monitoring facility for national security. That's not conspiracy theory; it's a fact. Certainly, space operations are monitored from that side. They basically cover that whole side of the Earth, just as NORAD covers our side of the planet, so to speak. That particular facility would definitely be the place that perhaps he might have been traveling to or from. If he knew something that he shouldn't have known, or perhaps he got frustrated and said, this is it, I'm going to release the information, then, of course, he may have suffered this unfortunate accident. So, and again, I don't have any direct proof, of course. I can't investigate an Australian crime scene, but...
So that's just one of the strange facts that you look at it and sort of raise an eyebrow and say,
Well, yeah, exactly, and it's not, again, if it was just this one incident, if it was just, this guy died in a car crash, okay, fine. But, I mean, when you look at the whole series of events and how things transpired, the whole hysteria that occurred and the conspiracy theories that came about long before, not conspiracy theories, I really shouldn't say that, but, the skeptics will call it conspiracy theory, so whatever. But if you look at the facts, And everything that built up to it, I mean, certainly it was an extraordinary event. And if you have a fact that says, we have a flap on January 10th, and then you find out, as I did, by really investigating it and getting into the astrophysics and the orbits and everything else, and looking at, if these things were true, and you find all these ancillary things like the orbit was close enough, and it made a course correction after it went around Jupiter the same way that we make a course correction of the spacecraft that we were sending, to do an aerostationary break maneuver, basically, is what it's called. I mean, it really just, it's difficult to ignore it. And you sit there and you go, and again, as you know, I'm a witness. I was a witness to the bull ring on March 12th, 1997, so I've seen these things. And they defy explanation. They really do. And you have to find some type of logical explanation. And when you see the evidence pointing to, a possible explanation of that, you have to consider it.
All right.
You think it might be.
All right. Let's open up the telephone line. And, folks, the line is open for you if you have a question or a comment for William Warrick. And the telephone number is 602-539-9580. And we'll take your call, your questions, your comments. And William, is there any connection? Because, I have lots of guests, and each guest brings their own satchel of information, and we've heard lots of stories about there being a connection between HARP and the UFO phenomena. I've never heard anybody actually nail down a connection. Do you think there is a connection?
Absolutely. There's no question. In fact, in my book, which should be published very shortly here in the next couple months, I don't think I've ever told anybody this. I'm glad you asked that question, because I don't think I've been able to get in depth with this. In the 1950s, a book was published by Major Donald Keyhoe called Flying Saucers Are Real.
Yeah.
He was an active duty military guy back when the United States actually took a lot of these things quite more seriously than they seem to today with how they handled it. And he documented in his book, there was a Canadian physicist, or I should say astrophysicist, or ionospheric researcher, I can't remember his exact scientific title. But basically, the Canadians had already sort of come and admitted to him, Wilbur B. Smith in particular, that they had were in the process of perfecting a technique by where they would radiate electromagnetic energy and bounce it off of the ionosphere and use that electromagnetic energy to power anti-gravity craft so that they didn't have to have engines in the weight of engines and et cetera, et cetera. And that if they were, seriously considering and contemplating and design board designs for this in 1950, then the later on version of that whole program is HARP. I mean, that's basically what HARP can do if you've extended 50 years into the future with the technology. So if you look, for instance, at the development of the HARP program on February 28, 1997, is when they began a period of testing for what was called the a one-quarter size version of the developmental prototype called the DP prototype. If you look at the height or the beginning of the UFO flap, which culminated on March 13, 1997, with the boomerang sighting in Phoenix, Arizona, the HARP facility began broadcasting its large antenna array on February 28th. On the very same night, a huge discoid UFO was seen over Phoenix Airport between 2 and 3 a.m. by aircraft controllers. On that very same night, February 20th, 1997, the gamma ray burst occurred, which is a very unusual characteristic of this particular gamma ray burst. And also on the same night, hail bob brightens dramatically. Now, take those four little things, lock them in a box, keep them on the side of your head. If you go forward from that point on, 2 weeks, you basically have a growing crescendo of UFO sightings and incidents, which peaked on March 13th and then died on March 14th, 1997. And the interesting thing about this and the connection to HARP is that on March 14th, 1997, that was the day that the developmental prototype of HARP stopped broadcasting. So the evidence that it tells, that what that tells me is that we sent up our anti-gravity aircraft to intercept the extraterrestrial anti-gravity aircraft, and that's why we have such a sort of confusing series of UFO reports that sort of seem to describe the same thing, but in different kinds of ways.
All right, let's go to the telephone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Good evening, Kevin. This is Steve in Fort Worth.
Hi, Steve.
I was going to ask your guest. Actually, I have one comment and then a question. Now, the HARP program, the way I understand it, it was developed to, now the official word is it was developed to propagate sound waves easier across, bounce it off the ionosphere to make it go farther rather than have the short wavelengths that we use today. That's one comment. And then my question is, this is really what I'm calling about, is that, some of the military aircraft that were involved in the UFO chase episodes, I know that in the radome of any military aircraft that there is a radar. And I'm wondering if this radar data has ever been looked at, because I'm sure that it's recorded, so that in the event something happens, that the military can go back and look at the data to find out what exactly happened. And I wonder if you'd guess the comment on that. I will hang up and listen.
All right. Thanks for the call. What about these aircraft that you were talking about that all within a 6-day period of time, they all either went missing or crashed? Has anyone looked at the radar tracings of those? Do you know?
No, and I have two comments on that. Number one, I mean, they're military aircraft, so you know, the FAA doesn't really have any jurisdiction over that. As far as I know, and I could be wrong on that, although I think they can become involved like the NTSB and stuff like that. I mean, if it's a military crash, it's basically handled by the military, you know, so the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, for instance, the one that handled Craig Button's case. The second thing is that by all definitions, by all indications, by definition, an anti-gravity aircraft, or anti-gravity craft, I should say, is going to bend the gravity wave. It's going to bend space-time just by its very existence. So by all indications, from civilian and other, and I can make another comment on the civilian aspect of this, but by all indications, these craft are, by definition of the propulsion systems, invisible to conventional radar. Now, it does not mean that they're invisible to infrared and or ultraviolet or other parts of the spectrum, and there seems to be a lot of evidence, especially lately, although I have not had a chance to investigate it fully, that in fact, if you have the capability of having a device that can see in different spectrums, that these craft are showing up. In fact, for instance, George Norrie apparently has seen some sort of infrared UFO. I don't know if you heard about this.
Oh, I had the guy on the show, yeah. Ed Grimsley is his name. Ed Grimsley discovered that if you use night vision goggles, the really nice ones, the expensive ones, that you can see UFOs that you can't see without them. Yeah, I've had him on the show. He's the one that showed George Norrie through his night vision goggles.
Yeah, that's what I heard, exactly. So, now, the other interesting thing, and I have heard this directly from an air traffic, senior air traffic controller of local civilian airport, that apparently in the past couple of years, and I don't know how long ago, when they upgraded the a lot of the international airport radar systems, they actually modified the software, some of the hardware, so that they didn't pick up some of these UFOs. And her comment to me, quote unquote, was that if they hadn't done that, they would be seeing these things all the time.
I had John Callahan on the show, and he used to be the number two man in the FAA. And he told us that is true. It has been altered. It does pick them up. However, because the way the program is written, it puts all the data for what you would think are UFOs. It doesn't show up on the controller screen. It puts that data into a side of the computer for weather. And well, it reads it as a weather anomaly.
Well, then there you go. You've just got confirmation, because I did not know that. And I can guarantee you that the person that gave me this information is not that person. And that she knew what she was talking about.
So, well, you know what, though? That really gives... William, really gives a whole new perspective to the Chicago O'Hare incident, because what did the FAA spokesperson say? She said perhaps they saw a weather anomaly.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, there's a total blackout on that. That was actually, you know, the thing, as you recall, that got me really kind of upset and got me to do the conference and sort of really come forward with all this stuff. I guess you just reach a point in the life where you're just sick of all of it, and you can't sit there and just be silent anymore.
You know, in if you take her statement and you put it next to what John Callahan said about the way the software has been rewritten, so that it takes all of these UFOs and puts them over in the weather side and lists them as a weather anomaly, she could be telling us, sort of in a coded way, that it was over there as a weather anomaly.
Absolutely, no question.
All right, we have to take a break, and we'll be back, ladies and gentlemen, after this. The telephone line is open, and the telephone number is 602-539-9580. It is on your screen if you're watching our internet television channel. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. I am your host, Kevin Smith, and my guest this evening is William Warwick IV. And, William, we have a caller online, so let's go to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and where are you calling from?
Hi, this is Bob from California.
Bob from California, all right.
Howdy. I had a question for William.
All right.
My question is, is the logic and reasoning showing that it's an absolute positive that there's a lot of these things going on, and the fact that if there was nothing going on, there'd be not all this classification because there'd be nothing to hide? Thank you.
All right. What do you think about that?
I didn't quite catch the last part of what he said. Is declassification, is that what he said?
Well, I think I can repeat what he said, but let me say what I think the question is. Does logic and reason tell us that there's a lot of this stuff going on, and that's why it's classified? In other words, they wouldn't have all this classification stuff going on unless the stuff was real.
Yeah, there's no doubt. Well, I mean, if you just look at the way the government's reacted to all of it, and your audience doesn't have, obviously, like, for instance, the information that I gave you, which would take days and days to cover, clearly there is a sort of crisis going on right now. Although the rest of the world, in terms of the governments, the Brazilian government, the UK, the French, the Belgian, I mean, country after country over the past year and a half have all released a lot and declassified a lot of UFO information, and really the only government that has yet to declassify or become more open about all of these things is the United States government. Clearly there is they take it seriously, and clearly there is a vast effort that has been underway for God knows 60 years at least to discredit, to change the subject, to cover up any and all information related to extraterrestrials or UFO or anti-gravity craft for various reasons. But there's clearly an operation going on. It continues to this day.
I think he makes a good point, and that is that all of that classification would seem to indicate that, hey, this is real stuff. If it wasn't real, you wouldn't classify it.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And again, I think this goes back to the 50s, right around the time that information from Kehoe's book was released, quoting Wilbur Smith and the Canadian scientists as saying that they were perfecting, powering discoid anti-gravity craft with a HAARP-type, antenna array, bouncing the energy off of the ionosphere. At that same time, you also have T. Townsend Brown, who was the discoverer of the Brown B field effect, who was also perfecting this from a different sort of tack, not using the HAARP type facilities, but by using ultra high capacitors to create I would call it a block wall, which we can get into lots of physics details here, but basically was creating his own type of anti-gravity craft and having apparently a lot of success, and then all of a sudden the National Research Lab that he was working for, the NRL, shuts him down, cuts his funding, and basically takes his research. And by the way, I have been in touch with his daughter, so who has really been sort of in the background. No one doesn't even really want me to know her name, her true name. But this is certainly the case. So this technology has been around for a long time, and part of the reason that it's classified is because it is we do have our own anti-gravity cap. And I'll give you a little tidbit of information that you may not, you probably are aware of, that the day before 9/11, Donald Rumsfeld got on CNN and announced that the Pentagon can't account for $2.3 trillion. Well, where do you think that $2.3 trillion went?
You know, I had not. I do remember him saying that, and I don't think that I had ever made the connection. You're saying that it went into the development of our own anti-gravity spacecraft.
Well, $2.3 trillion buys a lot of million-dollar hammers, I think, you know?
Well, yeah, that's a lot, $2.3 trillion that they can't account for. And, you know, I don't think that anything else was said about that after 9/11.
Of course not. So connect the dots.
So, but as far as you're concerned, you think that's where it went?
Oh, there's no question. It's the greatest. When the facts come out, and Edgar Mitchell and, you know, Steve Bassett's working with the Disclosure Project, you know, the truth will come out. They can't hide it because they can't control what the extraterrestrials are going to do. But when the truth does come out and the American people realize that this project, which has been going on since 1947, and a lot of people would argue long before that, is without question the greatest expenditure of resources, not just money, but, I mean, intellectual, national security, defense. I mean, it makes the Manhattan Project look like, a game of checkers. And so, you know, certainly if this is not the explanation for the missing $2.3 trillion, then the greatest criminal act in history has been committed against the American people. And
Well, have been so many massive criminal acts committed against the American people.
Political aspect of it, so I'm going to let you roll with that on your own terms.
I'm not talking politics here. I mean, but just in my lifetime, time after time after time after time, we the people have been screwed. And, it's happening again as I speak. And I think people are numb to that now. People are just barely a little upset over this thing.
Well, let's think about the economic impact. You know, let's really, 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 really be honest with ourselves here. All right, if this is true, and I think that it is, that $2.3 trillion was spent on these, you know, reverse engineering projects. Could that be the reason why we're actually in the financial situation, or a huge part of the reason that we're in the situation that we're in now? Because here's the thing. All of the best technology and the best minds and the best resources and the best, you know, money out there is devoted to this particular endeavor. By that, I mean Lockheed Martin, Boeing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And all of that research trickles down to us, you know, 20, 30 years later with Teflon and aerogels, which were, you know, invented in 1931. You know, a lot of the technology that we need to solve a lot of our environmental problems is on the shelf in some laboratory in the United States, in Lawrence Livermore, in Lassen Langley. I worked to do this, you know, coming out of college with Jenna Merck, and I worked at the Langley Research Facility and the Surrey Nuclear Power Plant to try and bring some of these technologies to market. These things are out there. But because of the brain drain and the, you know, financial funneling of all of our you know, best talent into these projects, it's killing us. It's killing not only us, but the rest of the world. It's prohibiting our evolution.
Well, perhaps we have reached the tipping point on this. I certainly would hope so. If we have not reached the tipping point, we're very, very darn close to it. I don't think that all efforts at secrecy are going to be successful for very much longer on this UFO issue. And that brings up the February meeting this past February, the meeting reported to have taken place at the United Nations, where it was a meeting led by the U.S. and involved about 40 countries. And the topic of discussion was the need to acclimate the world's population to the fact that UFOs are real, extraterrestrials are real, they have been and are visiting the planet. And what do you think about that? What do you, you think that's underway?
That's a funny thing you bring that up. Here's what I can tell you. The Native Americans, as you know, the Native American cultures, various tribes, have had for quite some time, it's almost common knowledge now, that a lot of these tribes have been actually in contact in the past, as well as presently, with extraterrestrials. In fact, I was just in New York about a week and a half ago, and I had the privilege and honor of being introduced to Chief Looking Horse of the Sioux tribe of the Lakota. And he was at the United Nations. I have to choose my words very carefully here. When I was up in New York, that's what he was there for. Not only to give the speech that I met him at in the Open Center in New York, but prior to this last visit by Chief Looking Horse to the United Nations to discuss some of these things that we're talking about. He had actually, and a number of Native American tribes had made a trip to the United Nations, and I think you're aware of this, I think we talked about this before, in the mid-90s, basically for the same purpose, which is to warn the United Nations about a lot of the potential dangers that we are presently in the midst of, not just environmental, not just war, but that, as you say, the boiling over of all of these things, you know, if not addressed now, immediately, has the potential for great destruction. Not just in the sense of extraterrestrials coming to invade us or anything like that, but just sort of our own folly of not recognizing what is really and truly going on around the world. So the whole idea of this, United Nations, you know, again, it goes back to the Brazilians and the French and the British, all of them, rest of the world, basically coming out and saying, yeah, we need to deal with this. This is real. And the United States government, hopefully things are going to change with the new administration, who has sort of kept the bottle on this, and the bottle's about to explode. And we don't know what's going to happen when that happens.
Well, yeah, I'll tell you kind of where I think we are, and let me warn you, we have a break coming up here in just a few seconds. I think, you know, the genie is out of the bottle, and for people who are alive and alert and not just sheeple, and they've really looked at the evidence on this thing, the genie's out of the bottle. The debate as to whether UFOs are real is a dead debate. It's over. It's done. It's toast. Stick a fork in it. That's no longer a debate. They are real. And the evidence says so. And in fact, the U.S. government has officially stated that they are real. In Project Blue Book, by saying they had a certain percentage, I think 12%, something like that, that they couldn't explain. Well, that's saying they're real. The genie's out of the bottle. The only thing that's not out of the bottle is there's still this secrecy apparatus, and I think there are people trying to force that into the daylight. All right, we have to take a break. We'll be back right after this. More with William Warrick and your telephone calls. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. And my guest, William Warrick. William, let's go straight to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name, and from where are you calling? Hello, caller. Well, I do not. Oh, I see. Caller, I apologize. We put you on hold and didn't realize it. You're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name, and where are you calling from?
This is Charles in Albuquerque.
Hi, Charles. How are you this evening?
Good, good.
What's on your mind?
Oh, I just had a question that passed my mind. I was curious why the guest, I don't know if you've covered this in the previous conversation because I joined a little late, but why he developed an interest in UFOs and this sort of subject.
That's an excellent question. What about that, William?
Well, that's a good question. Well, of course, the main thing that got me involved, I had a sighting in Norfolk, Virginia on March 12, 1997, which was actually the day before the Phoenix Lights events on March 13, 1997. And to make a long story short, I witnessed basically a 600 to 800 foot wide, might have been 400 foot wide. It's very difficult to tell the size of aircraft like that. I should say spacecraft. But basically, I witnessed this huge, immense boomerang-shaped object basically float over my head. I got on my CB radio, intercompany radio that was in my work truck at the time, and I basically just said, hey, you know, is anybody else in my area? I just saw this, you know, really incredible object go over my head. And that was it. So, you know, the other technician that was working replied that he wasn't in the area, he didn't see anything. I didn't think that much of that particular reporting of that incident. I didn't report to anyone else. That was it. Although I wasn't really a great deal of shock over what happened. And I called in sick the next day, which was March 13th, Thursday, tried to peruse the internet and find, you know, news stories. I really expected the next day that this would be like the biggest story on Earth, you know. And I was shocked and amazed to find that there wasn't a murmur about what I had seen. And that really disturbed me and really scared the living, you know what, out of me. So the next day was March 14th after that. That was Friday, March 14th. I called in sick again, but for a different reason. I had a friend of mine from high school that had actually died in a car accident on March 13th. A true story, was a son of a state trooper in Massachusetts. My boss shows up at my doorstep, been working for this company for over a year, with the assistant manager, basically fires me on the spot. And his only reply was that, you know, because I reported a UFO. And so that really started the whole thing, you know, basically ruined my life at the time. I was my senior year of college, get my degree. And it really...
Now, he actually said it was because you reported a UFO. He actually said that?
Yeah, his exact words, I said, I mean, I kind of knew that he never been to my house before, so I kind of figured it had something to do with the UFO, but I never thought that they would just fire me on the spot like that.
Yeah, but he said it?
Did he get?
He actually said it's because you reported a UFO?
His exact words were, come on, Bill, a UFO?
Well, Charles, you have you're involved in the legal profession. Is that something that it's legal to fire someone for?
Well, I suppose it actually is. I mean, you know, you could say, well, somebody who sees UFOs, I think that people like that are crazy, and I have to have people who are dependable on the job, so I got to let him go.
All right. Now, let me ask you this question, Charles. We file that happens, and he files a lawsuit against the company that comes before you, and William starts presenting witnesses in court that are physicists, astronomers, astronauts, Albert Einstein, his writings presented as evidence in court that greatest scientific minds have written about these things. They've seen them. They don't know what they are. Would he win his case?
Well, I don't know. In front of me, I'm afraid I would have to disqualify myself because I've seen them myself, and I know they're here.
I think he would win the case, though, in any court of law.
I think he would. I think there's certainly enough evidence to convict, to carry that case beyond any reasonable doubt.
Yeah, I think so. Charles, thanks for the call, man. Very interesting.
I would say it's a life-changing incident.
Yeah, it is.
Well, I have one funny comment to make on that. I would call as a character witness and as a sort of circumstantial witness, Governor Mike Symington.
Yeah. Well, and yeah, I mean, you could call Jimmy Carter. He filed a UFO report, and he made it to president. So, I mean, you know, I really, and I've said this on the show many times, when you have an employer that says, okay, well, you think there are UFOs or you think there's extraterrestrials, we don't need people like you here, you're gone. Sue them. You will win.
You know, we talked about this before, Kevin, and I'll tell you from the bottom of my heart, had I known what I know now, what I didn't know then, I would have done just that. And if that had happened today, I
would... sorry about that. I pushed a wrong button.
But you know what I mean? I believe me, unfortunately, the statute of limitations is up. Statute of limitations in Virginia for tort law is 3 years. And in the year 2000, I mean, I was still really, really recovering from what had happened, because not only did I lose my job and my only source of income, my only form of transportation, which is my work truck, which I was leasing from the company, but I lost my reference. And as a 26-year-old kid who's been working for, you know, a company for 1 year, just building up his references, you know what I mean? To lose your most recent reference for a year because I could never use them as a reference, it was devastating.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I had that happen to me one time, and it happened with a very large corporation, and there was this secret meeting where it was said in the meeting, well, you know, Smith, he believes in UFOs. No, he believes in little green men, which is a lie. He believes in little green men. We don't need a guy like that, and as long as I'm here, he's never going to work for us again. Well, what they failed to understand is that I am excessively talented at getting information, excessively talented at it. And I found out about the meeting. I found out the date, the time, what office it was in, who was there, and who said what. And I said on the air that I had that information and that I intended to own them. Within 3 days, I was hired.
Well, yeah, you know, and that's one of the biggest things, you know, for instance, I was really trying to push her, and I may have to pull up the mantle again, you know, take the flag up on that again, you know, was the UFO Reporting Act, which is a piece of legislation that I have proposed. I'm still trying to garner support for it. I have gotten some support from certain individuals within the political community. To basically pass a basic civil rights law which protects the rights of those witnesses who want to come forward and report a UFO, period. Now, you would think, like you've pointed out many times before, that this is, you know, a right, so to speak, that would be covered by the Bill of Rights or the freedom of speech. But in fact, if you just look at my case alone and the point that you just brought up, you know, if you were fired because you were black, if you were fired because you were a minority, if you were fired because you were old, elderly, handicapped, infirm, or have blue eyes and 3 feet, then you could sue any company based on discrimination, based on the laws that are on the books. But I have yet to see any case that's been prosecuted against any company or the FAA, which is a civilian organization, hold accountable corporations for that type of discrimination. And it's a travesty of justice in this country that we don't have a law like that to protect us.
All right, William, we're out of time. I agree with you. Stay on the line with me for just a moment, if you will. Ladies and gentlemen, I wish we had more time, but we don't. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do, too. You can call me whatever you'd like to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.